Joining us now to dissect This Week in Politics is E.J. Dionne, a columnist for The Washington Post and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and David Brooks, columnist for The New York Times. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Let's start with what we just heard in Mara's piece, Wesley Clark's meteoric rise. What's his appeal? And David, were you surprised by his surge to the head of the pack?
His appeal is people love a guy in a uniform, and I was incredibly surprised. We've been paying attention more or less to these nine candidates for a long time. Suddenly a guy comes in people know very little about, and suddenly he's number one. He surges all the way to the top in nationwide polls. That's simply astounding. But I think what Clark understands is the same thing Dean understands, which is this race is not about the economy. It's about not being intimidated by Bush and being able to convince Democratic voters that you're going to declare war on Bush. And you don't need 10-point plans. If you can persuade them of that, you're going to do pretty well with this field. The other thing that marks the field is that the senators who are in the race are all reasonably conventional. 49 members of Congress have run for office for the presidency in the last 40 years. They've all lost because they all tend to be conventional. Dean and Clark are not.
EJ, you know, the Dean camp is sort of quietly saying that his surge to the front is sort of like a Hollywood release. Big numbers on the first weekend, and then they expect that this might drop, or they hope that it might drop. Will there be some sort of market correction?
Well, they are praying that that's the case. I was told by a Democratic pollster this week that the polls differ depending on whether you put the word general in front of his name, and that the word general actually helps him substantially in these polls. I think the race changed in the last week, not only because Clark got into the race, but these polls showing for the first time in his presidency that President Bush might actually lose to somebody, these trial heats. It's the first time he's been behind. People can say, well, they're statistically insignificant, but I think they're politically very significant. And I agree with David on this point that the Democrats really are most interested in defeating George Bush. If you actually asked people for an honest answer, what's the most important issue in this election, they'd probably say the economy or Iraq. But beating Bush is the sign. And I think the danger for the rest of the Democratic field is this surge of Clark, because to some degree, it's a vote of no confidence in them. Now, Clark still is only at 22%. That may be a bit of an exaggeration. But it is a vote of alarm and a kind of prayer that Wesley Clark is everything that they hope he is.
So it says as much about the rest of the field as it does about him.
I think so.
David, as you noted in your column, the Bush camp seemed almost gleeful at the prospect of a run against Vermont Governor Howard Dean, who has been the front runner. Are they less confident about the prospect of a run against Wesley Clark?
Yeah, absolutely. They think they can take a guy from Burlington, Vermont, which is Howard Dean, and paint him as a New England liberal. And they're reasonably confident he will not play well in the South. He doesn't play in the upper Midwest. But Wes Clark is a different story. He's a guy who culturally plays very well in those places. So he's a much scarier prospect, I think, to them.
And while we're talking about Dean, do you think that he might actually enjoy this moment somewhat out of the spotlight? I'm sure he wants to hold on to front-runner status, but let the media sort of parse and pick at the front-runner and give him a bit of respite.
I think the Dean campaign felt that before they started looking at these polls. Just by the way, on Clark, I agree with David on that, too. Terrible thing, a lot of agreement today. One of the key factors in his rise is his strength among men. And Democrats have been historically weak among men. And I think one of the questions is, will he also pick up women? And if he could he combine those two, or is there a push away? Dean, yes, welcomed being out of the spotlight because Clark came in at the very moment when the Democrats were beginning to beat up on Dean and when the press was paying a lot of attention. But this could be too much of a good thing for them. And I think Dean would love to see a poll showing him much closer to Clark again. But we really can't know until we see polls in Iowa and New Hampshire, because if Dean still is strong up there, he is still in the very close to the same position he was before Clark got in.
Somebody told me today there can only be one gaffe guy, and Howard Dean was the gaffe guy until Wes Clark, and now he's the gaffe guy.
Hmm. Now, what of the other candidates, David? Both John Kerry and Dick Ephardt picked up some key endorsements today.
Right. Kerry is the one who's hurt most by Clark because he was the military hero. He was the guy running on security and strength. I don't think we should downgrade the other candidates, though. I think Gephardt's running a very strong campaign. I think John Edwards still has an outside shot. So as the focus turns on these two outsiders, I think there are professional politicians here who are going to last over the long term and who are much less unpredictable than the two frontrunners.
So it's sort of like running the 220. It's a long sprint, and those who can go the distance will be in good position.
Yes, and I think Gephardt's been very smart. He said, all right, I've got to beat Dean in Iowa. my strengths are economic, they're being a good, strong, in some ways old-fashioned Democrat, so he's gone after Dean on Social Security and Medicare. The interesting thing is both Gephardt and Edwards have made a large bet on economics, on a kind of economic populism. That has not been the flavor of the year. The flavor of the year has been much more a feeling about President Bush and the presidency and foreign policy. The question is, does the Democratic Party ever come back to its old-fashioned interest in economics, or is the party, as David has written, become much more upper middle class, and therefore these issues don't play the way they would have 10, 20, 30 years ago?
Well, speaking of the Republican Party, President Bush, who has basked in enviable poll numbers, is seeing some slippage now in the polls. And some Republicans are saying aloud what would have been anathema just weeks ago, that the president might be vulnerable come next November.
I do think they feel that, in part because they don't see how things turn around. The economy is doing pretty strong, but they don't feel that it's strong enough to create a lot of jobs. So you could have an unemployment rate similar to where we are, even in 2004. Republicans generally feel the situation in Iraq is a lot better than it's being reported in the media. There's a lot of political activity, which is very promising there. On the other hand, they do think there will be a casualty rate, and people in the White House have said this privately, the next 3 to 6 months. And so that's a drip-drip feeling of anxiety that will affect the American voter. I think they're still on the whole confident, but less so now than they were a month or two ago, because it's hard to see, for them to see, how you re-grab the agenda.
Well, when he was at the UN yesterday, President Bush insisted that progress is being made. But as we get closer to November, is he going to have to point to sort of tangible results to convince voters that we're getting somewhere in Iraq?
He will, and I think it's going to be hard. I've heard people who strongly support the president on Iraq say this can work, but it'll probably take a year or 2 years to really start working in a way that's highly visible. There'll still be the problems. There will still be the casualties. As a political matter, even if the president is right, he's going to face this sort of drip, 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 this problem of casualties, the problem of disorder in Iraq, and it's going to take a while to put it back together. I thought it was also striking that it's a sign of a real change that the president's now given two speeches on Iraq. The first speech is remembered mostly for one number, $87 billion, and that's what's hurt President Bush. And Republicans, who are no friends of foreign aid, are very uneasy about committing that kind of money, even though they'll ultimately vote with the president. In the speech yesterday, it was striking that he devoted far more attention to the issue of international slavery and the international sex trade, which is, by the way, an important issue. He devoted far more to that than he did to the issue of weapons of mass destruction. And so neither of these speeches grabbed people. And one of his problems is he doesn't have Saddam Hussein to kick around anymore. He was a great guy to run against because he was evil, to use the president's words. He's gone. It's a harder case to make now.
David, this $87 billion figure, I mean, Tom DeLay mentioned the word sticker shock. Is this give the Democrats an avenue to ramp up the rhetoric against President Bush?
And so it's difficult. How much higher can it go? No, they're going to vote for that $87 billion because at the end of the day, we can't fail in Iraq.
Okay. Thank you very much, both of you.
Thank you.
E.J. Dionne is with the Washington Post and the Brookings Institution, and David Brooks is with the New York Times.